So we are in the second week of a series that we've entitled What Love Does. And this whole series is based off of a statement that Jesus made to his followers about his followers. And everything that we're talking about in this series comes back to this one statement that Jesus made. We kicked this off last week and kind of unpacked that statement together. And if you weren't here last week, we'll review it really quickly. But you can always jump online and listen to the message that way. But here's a statement that Jesus made. In John 13, Jesus says, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you're my disciples if you love one another." See, according to Jesus here, love is the number one apologetic for who we are and what we believe. Love is not a nice option for us as the church. Love is the essential ingredient that defines who we are. Love is what is going to cause the culture that surrounds us to sit up and take notice of what we have and wish that they had it too. Now, as we looked at this last week, one of the questions we asked at the end of the day was, okay, well, if that's the case, then what does that kind of love look like? Specifically, what does it look like for you and me to love each other in such a way that the people who walk through our doors would say things like, you know, I'm not sure about those people at faith. I'm not sure about what they believe about the Bible. What they say about God sounds kind of crazy to me. But man, the way they love each other there, I think they're following Jesus. It kind of makes me want to follow him too. And so what we're doing today and in each subsequent week is each week we're looking at a specific facet of love. Because love is complex. It is multifaceted. You're not going to cover all the different aspects of it in one week. And so each week we're just trying to put some handles on what that kind of love looks like as we explore together what love does. Now, as we begin doing that this week, we're going to look at a narrative from Luke's biography of Jesus' life. A little bit of a longer one, but in it, Jesus kind of models for us what love does. So let's read through it together. Here's what Luke writes. He says, "When one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at table. A woman in that town who had lived a sinful life learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house. So she came there with an alabaster jar of perfume. As she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears, and she wiped them with her hair, kissing them and pouring perfume on them. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, 'If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner.' Jesus answered him, 'Simon, I have something to tell you.' 'Tell me, teacher,' he said. 'Two men owed a certain moneylender money. One of them owed 500 denarii and the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back. So he forgave the debts of both. Now, which of them will love him more?' Simon replied, 'I suppose the one who had the bigger debt forgiven.' 'You have judged correctly,' Jesus said. Then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, 'Do you see this woman? I came into your house and you did not give me water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I have entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she poured perfume on my feet. Therefore I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven as her great love is shown. But whoever has been forgiven little loves little.' Then Jesus said to her, 'Your sins are forgiven.' And the other guests began to say among themselves, 'Who is this that even forgives sins?' Jesus said to the woman, 'Your faith has saved you. Go in peace.'" Now, that's a big section of scripture. And there's just a ton going on in that. And so what I want to do today is just take some time and just kind of re-narrate that section of Scripture and do so drawing out some of the culture and some of the history to try and help us maybe better wrap our brains around what Jesus is trying to model for us here as far as what love does. So, Jesus gets an invitation to dinner. Guess who's coming to dinner? It's Jesus tonight, right? So Jesus gets an invitation to dinner to Simon's house. Now, this is not Simon Peter the Apostle. This is Simon the Pharisee. And as such, Simon is an astutely religious man. He is super religiously conservative. Good church people in their day, they would get their cues from Simon on what it looked like to follow God. Now, why is a guy like Simon inviting a guy like Jesus to dinner? I'm not sure. Because again, Simon's a Pharisee. And Jesus was constantly in trouble with the Pharisees. I don't know if it's morbid curiosity. I don't know if he's going to try and entrap Jesus. I don't know if he's genuinely spiritually interested. Whatever reason, Simon invites Jesus to dinner. Now, a dinner invitation in Jesus' day came with certain expectations. There were just certain things you would do to be polite to the person you were inviting to your home. Not unlike today. Like, we get this. You invite somebody to your house for dinner, there's just certain things you're expected to do if you're going to extend common courtesy to that person. Same thing in Jesus' day. It's just that how courtesy was extended then is different than how it's extended now. It oftentimes means the same thing. It's just communicated differently. Now, Simon invites Jesus to dinner, but he doesn't extend any of the courtesies he's expected to. For example, Simon doesn't kiss Jesus. Now again, how you express courtesy is different then than it was today. So don't walk out here going, well, I'm going to be biblical. I'm going to invite somebody to dinner, and when they come into my house, I'm going to plant a sloppy, wet one on them, right? Because that's what they did in the Bible. That's going to make you the subject of a hashtag. Just leave that alone, all right? In Jesus' day, a kiss was the way you said, I'm acknowledging you're here. I'm so glad you've come. If it's somebody who's of equal social status, you would give them a kiss on the cheek. If it's somebody you want to honor in a special way, you would kiss their hand. It had nothing to do with affection. It had nothing to do with attraction. It was, I'm so thrilled you're at our house for dinner tonight. Now, Jesus shows up, and there's no kiss. This would be like me inviting you to dinner, and you knock on the door, and I shout, it's open, come on in, right? And you walk in, and I don't get up from the couch. I don't look up from the TV. I'm just like, put that salad in the kitchen, right? This is the equivalent here. It's rude. Jesus, he's invited to Simon's. There's no kiss. And there's no water for his feet. Now, this is important in ancient Israel. You've got dirt roads. They are shared with livestock. Livestock do what they're going to do wherever they want to do it, whenever they feel like doing it. And the closed-toe shoe has not caught on yet, all right? Feet get nasty. And you're coming to dinner. You don't sit at table. Luke said you recline at table. That means your feet are in your neighbor's face, and your neighbor's feet are right by your head. So clean feet, this is important. Now, a well-to-do host, he's got somebody, a servant who's going to wash your feet for you. A host who really wants to honor you, he might wash his guest's feet himself. But even the poorest of hosts, they're going to provide a guest with water so they can wash their own feet. Simon doesn't wash Jesus' feet. Simon doesn't even give Jesus water to do it himself. Again, this would be like you coming to my house for dinner, right? And after the meal, I get up and I drop a check on the table, expecting you to pay for the food you've just eaten. And you're digging around in your pockets. You're like, do we have enough cash to cover this? And you don't have to worry about that at our house. Because at the Rice House, we accept all major forms of credit cards, right? Plastic fantastic all the way. You just bring it, eat whatever you want. We'll just ring that baby up, right? You just don't do that, right? So Simon, there's no water, there's no kiss, and there's no oil. Now again, this is important in ancient Israel. It's hot. Nobody's invented deodorant. I mean, it can get as ripe as a middle schooler's gym locker there. I mean, it's just nasty. And so a little bit of oil, it just takes some of the olfactory edge off. It's just, you know, you just smell a little better after that. Yeah, this again, this is the equivalent of you come to my house in the middle of August and I'm not going to turn on the air. We're just going to sweat together, right? And just, I'll be honest, like I don't turn on the air at our house in the summer. It has to hit 90 degrees out before I'll turn on the air. I'm just cheap that way. When we invite guests, because my wife lives in our house, the air comes on, all right? All summer long, my daughter wants to, hey, can we invite them to dinner? Can we invite them to dinner? She doesn't care about you. She just wants the air on, right? Just how it works. So Jesus gets there. There's certain expectations. A kiss, water, oil. Simon extends none of them. Not one. And these aren't subtle omissions. In that day and age, every one of these had been just another fresh slap in the face. Everybody would have seen it. And everybody would have felt it. Like, you ever been there where somebody does something to someone else in public and it's rude and it's thoughtless and everybody sees what just went down and nobody wants to say anything, but now it's just super tense. Like at Simon's house, you could swim through the tension that night. All the guests see what Simon did and didn't do. All of them feel it. Both the invited guests and the uninvited ones. Now I say uninvited because dinner parties like this, they were almost public affairs. A well-to-do host, you don't do this in the house where it's hot. You do this out in the front courtyard in front of your house in the evening where it's cool. But anybody in town, they can kind of walk by and look over the fence and they can see who's at dinner. They can see what you're eating. They can stop and listen to your conversation, kind of watch the show. And people oftentimes did that. There were no cell phones to entertain people. You know, they had to watch something, right? And so they would watch the dinner parties. Luke tells us there's at least one uninvited guest. Probably more. But he tells us about one. Doesn't tell us her name. But he gives us enough indicators so that we know what her profession is. She's a prostitute. Luke doesn't tell us what drove her to that life. But again, history tells us how guys like Simon would have thought about this woman. She's unfit for the community of faith. She's morally bankrupt. Somebody who you didn't interact with if you could help it. See, Simon, he wouldn't have liked this woman sitting outside of his fence. Guys like Simon and his Pharisees, they didn't talk to her. They didn't eat with her. They wouldn't acknowledge her presence if they could help it. See, this woman had customers, but more than anything else, she'd be acquainted with rejection and condemnation. She would know what it's like to stand on the outside looking in. This woman, for her, doors opened at night, in secret, and in shame. But she's hurt. Jesus is going to be at Simon's. And there's no amount of rejection from Simon and his lot that's going to keep her from coming to see this Jesus. She's heard about the kind of things he said to teach about God. She's heard about the kind of men he's invited to be his closest followers. She's heard about the way he said to treat people. She's heard he even claims to forgive people of their sins. And so she's going. And that night, she sees Jesus. She sees a man who is so different than the other religious leaders sitting around the table with him. She sees somebody who seems to exude hope. Somebody who maybe could help restore her relationship with God. Somebody who forgiveness really seems possible through this man. She's seen somebody who seems to radiate love. And like everybody else at the table, everybody else at the party that night, she sees the way Jesus is treated. She sees all the insults. She sees all the injustice. And like everybody else, she's just waiting to see, like, what is Jesus going to do? How's he going to respond? Like, is Jesus going to get up? You know, it's like temple practice. He's going to turn Simon's table and storm out in a huff. Jesus going to, is he going to deliver one of those verbal zingers that he's just known for? Is he going to just publicly humiliate Simon for his gross negligence as a host? Jesus does the unthinkable. He does nothing. He says nothing. He does nothing. He quietly endures the humiliation. He does so with no form of protest. And it's just, she can't take it. The injustice is more than she can take. Something inside of her snaps. And then she does the unthinkable. She walks around the fence and through the gate. She invades the dinner party. She goes and she kneels down at the feet of Jesus. And now it is ghastly. When people realize she's in there, it is ghastly quiet. And you thought there was tension before, it's nothing compared to what it is now. And when this woman finally gets the courage to look up into Jesus' face, everything she heard about, everything she hoped for, is looking back at her. It's been a long time since this woman has really looked into a man's eyes. There's no lust there. There's no rejection. There's no condemnation. There's acceptance. There's forgiveness. There's love. And the emotion, it just wells up inside of her. And before she can grab it and get it back under control, it erupts. And the tears start streaming down her face. This isn't like one of these quiet, respectful weepings. No, this is a hot mess sob session. We're talking about a volume of tears sufficient to wash a grown man's feet, which is what she does. And when she's done wiping just washing the dirt and the grime off of Jesus' feet, she realizes she's got a problem. She's got nothing to dry him with. It's not like she's getting, you know, asked Simon to loan her a towel. And so on impulse, she lets down her hair and she dries Jesus' feet with her hair. Where Simon should have kissed Jesus' hand, she showers his feet with kisses. Where Simon should have poured oil on his head, she pours perfume on his feet. That perfume, that was important to her. Again, this is a hot place. Hygiene is not at an all-time high. A little bit of perfume makes her line of work a lot easier. A little less unpleasant. She empties the bottle on his feet. She is pouring out her old life in gratitude for a new one. She isn't going to need this anymore. Now, as all this is going on, Simon's watching. And probably what could best be described is disgust. And Simon's thinking to himself, he's going, you know, if this man were a prophet, he'd know. He'd know who's touching him. If he were just a little bit socially connected to the community here, he would know what kind of woman this is, that she's a sinner. See, that's all Simon saw. When Simon saw this woman, all he saw was her brokenness, where she fell short, her sin. And for Simon, what he saw defined who she was. And that drove how Simon responded to her and interacted with her. And how Simon treated her, it told a story about who Simon was. Now, the ironic thing is, Jesus did know. He knew who this woman was on a far greater level than Simon did. And Jesus knew what Simon was thinking. I kind of imagine this always freaked people out just a little bit. Like, you're just thinking something. It's just you. You haven't verbalized it. It's in your brain. And then Jesus is verbalizing what you're thinking and calling you out on it, which is what he does to Simon. He does so in an effort to try and get Simon to see himself. Try and get Simon to see his behavior and to try and get Simon to see this woman, maybe for the first time. Now, Jesus does this by telling Simon a story. Modern day version, it goes something like this. Now, Simon, I want to tell you something. Lay it on me, Jesus. Well, there's these two guys. They got a gambling problem, the both of them. They both owe their bookie a ton of money. One of them owes $5,000, one of them owes $50,000. Neither one of them can pay. They're not sure how they're going to keep the lights on, put food on the table. There's no way they can pay the bookie. Now, this bookie does something crazy. Rather than getting Bruno to go out and break their legs, he just forgives them their debt. Just wipes the slate clean for both of them. Now tell me, Simon, which one of those two gamblers do you think is going to love the bookie the most? Now Jesus knows this is a no-brainer. This is a duh kind of question. It's not meant to be difficult. It's meant to help Simon be introspective. And Simon, he's a little bit reluctant about giving an answer because he can tell the other shoe's going to drop. So finally he says, well, I suppose the one who is forgiven more. Bingo, Simon, you got it. And then Jesus delivers the reproof Simon thought was coming. While looking at the woman, Jesus speaks to Simon. Because again, when Simon sees this woman, all he sees is her brokenness. That defines her in Simon's eyes. Jesus is going to speak to Simon and look at this woman to try and get Simon to see this woman, to see what he sees, to see what God sees, to see the daughter of the king, to see someone made in the image of God. Now, is that image marred by sin? Sure. Jesus isn't denying that. But she's still made in the image of God, and as such, she has worth beyond Simon's ability to calculate it. Jesus is trying to get Simon to see what he sees. Somebody worth dying for. Somebody worth loving. And so Jesus looks at the woman and he says, Simon, do you see this woman? Which on the surface is a silly question. Simon saw her outside of the gate. Simon saw her invade his party. Saw her theatrics with Jesus at his feet. But Jesus, no, Simon, do you really see this woman? Can you see who she really is? Simon, I came to your house. You should have washed my feet. You wouldn't even give me water, Simon. And she's washed them with her tears and dried them with her hair. Simon, you should have kissed my hand. She's showered my feet with kisses. Simon, you should have poured oil on my head. She's poured perfume on my feet. Simon, I tell you, her many sins are forgiven as her great love demonstrates. But Simon, people who think they've been forgiven of little, when it comes to loving God and loving other people, they tend to love little. Can you see her, Simon? Now, what I want to do is kind of take half a step back from the narrative and just begin to think about, okay, that statement that Jesus made that we talked about right on the front end of this, what does that look like in light of what Luke has been telling us? For example, the people you go to church with, what kind of vision do you have for them? How do we see the people who are sitting in the pew with us, or down the pew from us, or across the room from us? What kind of vision do we have for the people we go to church with week in and week out and month in and month out and year out? How do we see each other? How do we see each other when that person we go to church with, they can't hide the fact anymore that they're less than perfect, when their brokenness rises to the surface, when their sin is on display for us to see. How do we see that person when their sin is impacting us personally, or it's hurting somebody we care about? How do we see them? Or what kind of vision do we have? What kind of vision do we have for one another when we're just doing things, and it's not even sin? Like that person we go to church with, they're just relationally backwards. They're just socially obnoxious. They're doing something, there's no moral standing to it, but it drives us nuts. How do we see them? Because, again, how we see them, it's going to drive how we respond. And according to Jesus, how we treat one another, it tells a story about who we are. Like, do we have Simon-like vision? Jesus and Simon, they both saw the same woman. But for Simon, his vision as woman, it was reduced to her brokenness, her shortcomings. That's all he could see. When we see each other, in the midst of our shortcomings, moral or otherwise, is that what we limit our vision of our brothers and sisters in Christ? Do we limit our vision to just that? And does that drive how we respond? Or do we have vision like Jesus? Yeah, they said what they said. Yeah, they did what they did. Yeah, we got burned in the process. But doggone it, that is still God's son. That is still God's daughter. Made in his image, marred though it might be, that is still somebody Jesus thought was worth dying for, that Jesus believed was worth loving. How we see each other, it's absolutely critical. The vision we have will drive our response. And our response, how we treat each other, tells a story about who we are. It's why Jesus said, by this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. You see, the vision I have for you, when you're less than perfect, if I let it be reduced to Simon-like vision, if all I see is your brokenness, more likely than not, I'm going to love you poorly. More likely than not, I'm going to front load my interaction with you with things like annoyance and frustration and condemnation and judgment and bitterness and resentment and more. And the culture that surrounds us, they're going to see that. And there's nothing about that kind of interaction that's going to make somebody stand up and go, wow, they're following Jesus there. I'd love to be part of that too. No, they're going to run from that. But if in my brokenness, you can have Christ-like vision for me, if you can still see me in spite of my shortcomings, that's God's son. He's made in his image. That's somebody Jesus died for and believed was worth loving. More likely than not, you can respond to me in love. And responding to me in love doesn't mean you ignore my shortcomings. It doesn't mean you never call me out on them. It doesn't mean you enable me in my dysfunction. It means that you're going to front load your interactions with me with things like empathy and compassion and understanding and forgiveness and maybe even redemption. And when the culture that surrounds us sees that, that'll grab their attention. That'll leave them thinking, maybe we're following Jesus and maybe they want to be part of something like that too. The ability to see another person the way that God sees them and then love them in light of that, it is so, so powerful. It's life-changing. Just ask Teddy Stollard. You don't know Teddy? Well, let me tell you about him. Teddy was the kind of kid who didn't get invited to parties. He slouched in his chair and he looked bored most of the time. He only spoke when spoken to, and then in monosyllables. He never dressed right. He had smelly clothes. He was a rather unattractive boy. Whenever his teacher would mark Teddy's paper, she got a certain perverse pleasure out of marking all the wrong answers. She'd put an F at the top with a little bit of flair. She might have known better, because Teddy's record was there for anyone to see. First grade, Teddy's a good boy. He shows promise, but he has a poor home situation. Second grade, Teddy is quiet and withdrawn. His mother's ill. Third grade, Teddy's falling behind. His mother died this year. His father's uninvolved. Fourth grade, Teddy is hopelessly backward. His father moved away. Teddy's living with his aunt, and he's deeply, deeply troubled. Christmas came that year, and all the children brought presents to school. The presents were carefully wrapped, except for Teddy's, which was packaged in brown paper and held together with scotch tape. It was marked for Miss Thompson from Teddy. Miss Thompson opened all the gifts for everyone in the class to admire one at a time. When she opened Teddy's, it was a rhinestone bracelet with all kinds of stones missing, and a bottle of perfume that was mostly gone. The other children started to laugh, but this time Miss Thompson caught herself. Snapping on the bracelet, she said, "Isn't it lovely, class? Doesn't the perfume smell nice?" At the end of class, Teddy approached her shyly and whispered, "I'm glad you like my gifts, Miss Thompson. All day long, you smelled like my mother. Her bracelet sure looked nice on you, too." After he left, Miss Thompson put her head down on the desk and she cried. She asked God to forgive her. She prayed that God would help her see what he sees when he sees a motherless boy. When the kids returned from Christmas vacation, Miss Thompson was a new teacher. She tutored the children who needed extra help, Teddy most of all. By the end of that year, he had caught up with most of his classmates. He was even ahead of some. After that, she didn't hear from Teddy for a while. Then one day she received a note. "Dear Miss Thompson, I wanted you to be the first to know. I'm graduating from high school. I'm second in my class. Love, Teddy." 4 years later, another note. "Dear Miss Thompson, I wanted you to be the first to know. I'm graduating first in my class. The university has not been easy, but I liked it. Love, Teddy." A few years later, another note. "Dear Miss Thompson, I wanted you to be the first to know that as of today, I am Theodore J. Stollard, M.D. How about that? I wanted you to come and sit where my mother would have sat at my graduation. You're the nearest thing to family that I've had. Love, Teddy." The ability to see what God sees, and then love another person in light of that. It is so powerful. It's life-changing. What do we see? In the midst of our brokenness, because all of us, we're less than perfect. What do we see when we see one another? What do we front-load our interactions with each other with? Because how we treat each other, it tells a story about who we are. By this, everyone's going to know that you're my disciples if you love one another.